Thanks, Gil, for introducing a lot of general issues, and thanks to our colleagues from Duke for those insights. We're going to progress through a series of other sections now that will get into some more specific details. There will be interest in thoughts about general principles. There'll also be interest in getting insights about the exact experiences, what went well, what didn't go well. Our goal, again, being if we can understand what happened, it will empower us more effectively to be able to make recommendations that we can then test out to say, would these procedures and policies, if they'd been in place, enabled us to prevent circumstances that arose at Duke. So in this next section, we're going to be talking about issues that we call oversight of clinical research, the general topic of oversight of clinical research. And in your TMQ document, you specifically stated that governance and oversight of science with direct implications for patient care can no longer be seen as residing solely within the purview of any one laboratory. A chain of accountability extending beyond the individual labs to scientific leaders at local and institutional levels must be established. So we'd like to pursue with you that general principle. There'll be a few questions that I'd like to start with. One of them would be, are there insights that our Duke colleagues can share regarding the strengths and vulnerabilities of several types of oversight to enhance research integrity? And then also what worked well and what didn't work well regarding these overall levels of oversight for the statement of task trials, and what are the most important changes that are needed to address those deficiencies. So talking about levels of oversight, and already in your comments you've mentioned some of these. It might start with the PI and co-authors, including quantitative experts. Another level would be protection of research participants, the IRB, the Independent Data Monitoring Committees. Another would be what we might call institutional processes, the school, the department, the center, the institute leaders accountable with the PIs for ensuring implementation of effective systems to achieve integrity. Another aspect of institutional processes that you were already addressing here would be cultivating an environment where data at all stages receive critical scrutiny, where frank dissent from colleagues is not only tolerated but encouraged, conflict of interest committees. And then, as we were just discussing, regulatory oversight, including obtaining IDEs when needed, and then external review processes, including peer reviews arranged by the institution and by journals. So there are multiple different levels, many of them within the institution, some external, that can play into this overall aspect of oversight to enhance research integrity. So to come back to the original set of three questions that we'd like to get your insights about, what are the strengths and vulnerabilities of each of these? What, in particular, in the context of the Duke trials, what did not work well? And what would be the most effective changes to what was in place that would address those deficiencies?
Maybe Sally and Mike and I should tag team this, because we have spent a long time, and it's so hard to know where to start. So you're going to have to help guide us as we go through it. So I guess we want to start with the principal investigator and the principal investigator's lab. This is the building block, and if we lose trust as a fundamental element of the research enterprise, in my opinion, we are lost, because there is no bureaucracy. There is no audit system that can overcome a fundamental lack of trust, because a crafty individual can make things happen in any kind of system. And when the ways audits are done or known, those can often be met with trickery on the other side. I've told a lot of people this in our global clinical trials. Almost 100% of the time now, we find at least one site that's falsified data. And the way we detect this is statistical process control. It's not on-site auditing for the most part. We've been involved in these discussions. So, but the culture in an individual laboratory is also critical, and this is not my domain. I live in a much more historically team-based environment of multi-center clinical trials where you're pretty much out there all the time anyway, no matter what. But in an individual laboratory, it may be different. I have ideas about how to approach it, and I think there's an interesting debate going on in the TMQ committee about how proscriptive to be. But it might be good to get Sally and Mike to make a comment about the individual laboratory director or principal investigator.
Yeah, I mean, even the individual laboratory investigator lives within a small unit that's well below the level of the entire institution. And I think one aspect we're trying to put forward in TMQF is that those unit leaders have to develop some sort of accountability plan or culture improvement plan where they speak directly to how they are going to encourage dissent, whether it be, you know, a sort of departmental data exchange meeting where people are encouraged to really criticize each other. I mean, it can obviously take all sorts of forms. And at the next level up, I think that fulfilling those plans can be part of the metrics of success of those local unit leaders. And we're sort of talking about different ways to do that within the translational medicine quality
framework. So what do you call those? What kind of plans? What is that?
Oh, sort of accountability plans. Is that what we're calling it?
So the dissent on that, let me give the opposite point of view, although I'm very much in favor of this, and now that we're about to start a university in China, we have to be a little careful about proscription of activities as people think about it. The other point of view, which some members of the committee have expressed, is, you know, forcing people to write plans doesn't really necessarily mean that anything is going to be different. It's a form of bureaucracy that can be regarded as onerous and not very helpful, and often is used as an excuse for the real deal. And I think there are, but I think if it's done right, having unit leaders actually specify, here are the meeting types of meetings that we're going to have, and here's the way we're going to handle it if a medical student or a postdoc raises a question about their research. I think it's useful to have thought about these things ahead of time and to publicly let people know how you're going to do it. Now, the other approach would just be to say good leaders ought to be overseeing, their sub-leaders in a way that if they're not doing this well, that they should be replaced. And those are two points of view, frankly, that we're discussing.
So when you talk about unit leaders, you're talking about who would be administratively in a position of responsibility. So
right, a chair or a center director.
So if we had this in place in Dr. Potty's research, who would have been the unit leaders, and what would have been the nature of this accountability plan?
Right. So in that case, I think we would have expected a plan from Hunt Willard as the director of the IGSP. And, as I said, it could take many forms. And I think I agree with Rob, there is, the cynical viewpoint is that you can put anything on paper. And I think the only way to make that actually work is to have the next step up. For instance, when Dr. Willard is reporting to the dean, the dean has to say, what have you done to fulfill the elements of this plan? Have you seen any things that cause you concern, et cetera? In other words, it has to be part of the judgment of the job performance of those unit leaders for it to really have any teeth.
So people who would have the insight sufficient to understand the research and yet still be somehow intellectually a bit independent.
Exactly.
Not just understand the research, but understand the spectrum of the research nationally, the criticisms and the dynamics that go on, and be aware at that level. So it's not enough to question within a university, but you need to be able to take that all in and digest it.
Are you drawing that comment? Are you drawing that comment just in general or specifically in this case? In fact, there was so much scuttlebutt about it.
I would say in general, even in, I'm a heart failure cardiologist, and even in my own areas of research, that becomes important even in very clinical aspects of science, because we may move something forward based on local standards of practice and our local thoughts about a subject. If that's disconnected from the global discussion on the topic and the discoveries and the debate that goes on, we'll be in error. Could be in error.
And they're going to be pioneering.
I mean, the one other critique that's come up of our current draft document says we will have accountability plans from the unit leaders, and they'll be updated annually, and they'll be part of the part of the assessment of their job performance to see if they did what they said they were going to do. The one other critique is we don't want to create a situation where scientific debate actually our creativity gets squelched because someone has a crazy idea that turns out to be right. And I don't think that's a risk, but there are people who are concerned that once you begin to have accountability plans and all, then everybody's going to be in lockstep doing what's seen by the leader as good science. And, you know, what would have happened with peptic ulcers if the guys who were completely out of step with their colleagues had been, you know, listened to everyone around them?
And look what did happen for 40 years.
Can I just follow up on Tom's question about how would this actually work or would have worked in the potty trials that we're discussing? I mean, walk us through what the process would actually be.
So, you know, this is obviously a bit of a sort of a hypothetical, but there were debates swirling in the literature. And, you know, in any scientific exchange, you'll often have scientific disagreement. You know, there's often scientific disagreement. But I would argue that when something like that escalates to the level of there are lots of other people outside writing letters or discussing it at scientific meetings, et cetera, you could imagine, in fact, a situation where a unit leader might call together the faculty in that unit to really discuss that science and to try to, you know, try to actively poke holes in it, try to look at it from different angles, try to say, what part of this do we all feel comfortable with? What don't we agree with? And so I think, you know, you can make it part of a unit leader's responsibility to kind of have an eye on what the literature looks like in the area that's covered by their faculty, because these units are not so vast that that's not possible. And really bring things, you know, into sort of the sunlight whenever there are those kind of debates raised.
I'll be a lot. Ross, go ahead. I want to be very specific about this because I definitely have ideas.
My comment would just be the difficult thing, and this is often the human element, that we are uncomfortable asking people to validate what they are doing because we trust them. And we would like to believe in that trust. And so it's very difficult for people at any level to ask for validation, ask for proof. We just don't do it. If somebody says that something is true, it is the norm that we, particularly if it's, so for example, a graduate student with whom you are working, you assume that what they are doing is truthful and don't ask for validation beyond perhaps the discussion of the methods and maybe looking at their books. So one of the problems we run into, if we want to get really into proving things, is going against human nature in a very fundamental way.
But I would argue that that's part of leadership because, you know, in our own laboratories, you know, I have found myself saying to people in the lab, it doesn't matter what I want the results to be. I want to hear what you really think. And I think the unit leaders and as an institution, the culture we want to propagate is much better to have dissent at the discovery level than allow problems to propagate over time.
There's another word you used earlier, which was not dissent, but challenge.
Exactly.
You know, challenge people to explain and to show the data. And let's not forget when we have figures in published articles, but preferably in laboratory meetings first, where every dot is right on the line. Hello.
So to be very specific about this, I mean, from my perspective, there are really two elements to the accountability plan, and that is in our draft document right now. One is, you know, what we've been discussing is a bit more nebulous. I think it's ultimately the most important thing because the system has to be built on trust. Trust is generated by the ability to mutually challenge without hating each other and exchanging ideas. But at the primordial level, in this case, if there had been an accountability plan, it would have asked some fundamental questions. Were there adequate data systems in the laboratory? Was there adequate biostatistical collaborations under the right conditions? Was there a conflict of interest system in place for this laboratory that would have assured that the research would have been done at the highest standards? Now, looking back, you know, we're talking about something that started in 2001 and has a lifespan of 2010. A lot changed during that decade. So it's not to say that if we had instituted this in 2005, we would have gotten the right answers. But knowing what we know now, I think an accountability plan would have made things better at what I would call a primordial level before getting to the clinical trials. And just a quick word about clinical trials, and particularly in academic medical centers. We're currently doing a project with the FDA where we're taking clinicaltrials.gov and we're making an analyzable database from it. And the most striking thing about it right now is that over 90% of the clinical trials have less than 100 research participants, and most of those are being done in academic medical centers. And when you look at them, you got to ask the question, what exactly is it that's being done here and why? There's just a lot of churn that goes on in the guise of either freedom or training fellows or all sorts of other things that happen. And the culture that's developed, which we're trying to change with our site-based research unit system, is if you're Dr. X treating heart failure patients and you got Dr. Y treating coronary disease patients next door, it's not your business what Dr. Y is doing. If Dr. Y can get funded and get through the IRB, then, you know, that's his business. What we're trying to do is to create a culture of accountability as a group for the work that's done, so there's more than one pair of eyes, even on the smaller research, which, you know, is not conducted with the same rigor as the multi-center clinical trials that are so highly regulated that we do. I think this is a fairly major issue in every academic medical center, and it still needs a lot of work when it gets to the clinical trials. In this case, as I've said, we had ambiguity between what the IGSP was doing and what the cancer center was responsible for. We've clarified that ambiguity going forward. It doesn't mean things will always be done right or perfectly, but it does mean that people know who's accountable, and it's not just the PI in a clinical trial. It's also the head of that SBR, and it's part of the annual job performance, the quality of the research being done in that unit.
I just wanted to follow up on Rob's comment on the additional set of eyes. In some areas of our genomics research programs, and this may get to a practical issue that you raised, how do you do this? We've set up something that we call statistical redundancy. That is to say, we really want to see different independent statistical groups arriving at whatever results they arrive at, hopefully similar results or the same results, but if there's discordance, then that's something that raises a flag and something that perhaps worth investigating. So while I know we want to get to the level where we have statistical proficiency, and just at least one set of good statistical eyes looking on these data, and there's resource issues in getting twice that number of statisticians to look at it, I think it it actually pays dividends in the long term, because if you can catch something in the discovery stage, it doesn't propagate downstream and get us into situations like we're in.
And of course, what right will now be important there will be the degree of what is reviewed when you talk about statistical redundancy.
So I'm talking about sharing the primary, having the primary data sets, and go out to completely independent groups. I'm talking about having those groups not attempt to analyze the data using more than one methodology, preferably similar, different methodologies at each group. And it's not hard to imagine that in the genomics field there are many different methods that could be used to analyze complex data sets, and then coming back and reviewing the findings of that in a very organized way.
But including the ability to go back to the original source of the data to validate the accuracy of the data that you're then going to move into analyses.
That's correct. So in this case, this is the we're talking about the primary molecular data and the primary clinical data going out to these to groups independently. That's correct. Not summary data.
No. Rob, I've got a question for you. And just for instance, if you could clarify for me the accountability plan and the unit leader. We all live in very complex academic centers. We're leaders, as department chairs or institute directors or center directors, have virulent amount of power. And the question that I have, as I listen to the accountability plan, which I think makes conceptual sense, but I want to get a practical response regarding how much authority does a unit leader have relative to the department chair or the institute director or center director to actually call, basically call the investigator on fulfillment of their accountability plan. How do they seize that authority, and do they, and who actually gives them that authority?
We were in a meeting the other day on a different topic, and somebody said, if you ask our faculty at the university who is their boss, they would say no one. And that's a fundamental historical view of universities. But I think when it comes to human application of research, I think society and academic views have moved along that now this can happen. And I mean, the way I see it, we have a chancellor, we have a dean, we have department chairs and institute and center directors. Fundamentally, when it comes to research, the department chairs and institute and center directors are interchangeable, in my view. Okay. They each have, if it's a small center, the center director may be the unit leader. If it's a large department or a large institute, there'll be a plan for the institute or the center, but then there'll be subsections that will have their own plans. And I think the only feasible way for someone like Sally to have accountability is to deal with, you know, the 25 people who are at the level of a department or a center or institute. They've got to deal with their own people, and then there has to be, in those plans, there has to be a culture where things surface when they rise above.
So are unit leaders synonymous with directors and chairs?
Or
interchangeable?
In the case of, say, our Department of Medicine, which has over 500 faculty, the unit leaders would be the division chiefs. In IGSP, which has several centers within it, it might be a center leader. But the difference is a change from a view that each faculty is on his or her own basis, with a funding agency and the IRD being the intermediaries, to now adding that there's accountability of the people they report to in the institution.
Making the mistake, this is a very long cultural change. Particularly as you push deeper and deeper towards laboratory science. Our own journey with these site-based research units began probably 10 or more years ago, and began across our university and healthcare system about 5 years ago. And it has taken some amount of time, including continued reinforcement from leaders, so that they understand that site-based research is a professional activity, it's a group activity, and if I want to do a study, I have no academic freedom to do that study. I do it as part of the group. The group decides if we do it or not, budgets, the appropriateness, whether we have the adequate patients, and we track it as a group. It's a group activity. That takes continual reinforcement from leadership and cultural change, so that the junior faculty widely accept it, and we're in a better place now than we were 2, 5, and 10 years ago. But for a new faculty member arriving at our university from another university who might be a full professor level, it is quite a cultural change.
The other thing is that everybody has to know what unit they belong to, and every leader has to know who they're responsible for. And that sounds trivial, but, you know, if somebody's in an institute, they're also in a department. But the truth is that people tend to have a primary intellectual home, and they have to identify it, and the unit director has to acknowledge that that person is within their purview.
We had to go through this with the site-based research unit. So if you can imagine a pediatric anesthesia study, does that belong in the pediatric site-based research unit or the anesthesia? And there are reasons you could argue either way. But unless you have a primary accountability system, then things can fall through the cracks, in our view. And we've had to adjudicate every single one of those. And it's actually worked out well now. It's forced some interesting discussions between the different groups about how they want to work.
So the unit leader not only has to know who they're responsible for, they have to know whether or not they've been engaged at the right times.
Right.
How does that happen?
So, you know,
Imperfectly.
I think, again, though, this goes back to the issue of the open discussion of issues. In other words, it's rare for a faculty member to be so isolated that nobody else knows what's going on, and nobody knows what they're doing. And so, you know, I think having units that are small enough that there's really intense scientific exchange and the expectation that they're going to be examining each other's work would go a long way towards that, not a kind of I'm just an island and I don't have to pay any attention to what my neighbors are doing.
Can I just, to follow up on your point about just culture, in the sort of just culture philosophy, accountability is bidirectional. And so who would review the site-based research unit director's work?
So that's actually set up in a very formalized way now. So we have a scorecard centrally that concerns all aspects of the director's work, from are they providing enough biostatistical support to their investigators, to do they help people with preparing grants, to how do they select protocols for their portfolio, et cetera. So part of that has been to really engage the directors in this discussion. So we meet every week. We talk about what the criteria should be. So there's no surprises at the back end. Everybody knows what they're expected to do, and they're called to task if it's not done. I'll say something else, which is comes back a little bit to the original question, which is there are features you can build into this that takes things a little bit more out of the individual hands. So, for instance, in the clinical research realm, we've now made a change where clinical research coordinators are not reporting for the purposes of promotion or salary setting, et cetera, to the PIs on the trials. They're all reporting centrally to the research practice managers up to the medical directors of the site-based research units. Similarly, each site-based research unit has to have a quality assurance committee where they're also doing internal auditing, not only relying on the university, on the medical school auditing procedure. And there is a subgroup of the SBR directors that are essentially examining the quality assurance activities of each SBR. So it's really building in a series of internal overlapping controls where, you know, everybody's sort of observing what everybody else is doing, and you don't put people in a position where, for instance, coordinators, where they're going to play fast and loose with the rules because a PI is pressuring them and they're not going to have any career advancement if they don't do that. In other words, by taking, in essence, the temptation out of the equation, it really converts it into a professional activity where people know what their responsibilities are, and if a coordinator feels that things are being done improperly, they go to the research practice manager, who's their boss, and say, this doesn't look right. And the research practice manager goes to the medical director, who then has to deal with the investigator, often with the help of the department chair.
It seems to me this relates to some extent to the issue we discussed earlier about competition, which can be intra-unit
right.
competition.
Right.
I'm thinking about the site-based research units own scholarship.
Yes.
So what if that person has a patent pending and is concerned about disclosure of what might be a proprietary idea or proprietary
right.
data at a certain point?
Right.
That person's also in a role modeling position.
Right.
You know, we talk about the hidden curriculum in medical education. Well, there's sort of a hidden curriculum in research
right.
as well. So how does the person who's responsible for accountability mm-hmm. model a certain kind of behavior with respect to his or her own
right.
scholarship?
So, you know, there are a lot of answers to that, and I'll defer to Rob momentarily. But I will say that part of the internal control we've built in is that the committee of faculty, essentially, within the SBR has to approve of a protocol before it will actually move forward to IRB approval. And the way that we've built that in is that you have got to get an SBR sign-off electronically in the system before it can even move forward now. So I agree, when it's a lead group leader that may be having issues, I think that, you know, again, the SBR medical directors are reporting up to a chair or the head of a center. And so that's something that we need to think about, I think, how we build in the controls on those, their own work. I think that's important.
Well, Dave, you had a question, then I want to try to move us ahead here. But go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, can I just comment very, very quickly? This actually specifically came up, what you addressed. And among the site-based research units that are functioning in group practices already, the clinicians have already accepted that they've got to work together. Not to say that it's perfect. There are many issues still to be worked out. But we had a few that were still in the solo practitioner style, and actually this very specific issue, I don't even want to share with members of my own department what my intellectual property is because they might steal it. And our response to that was, that's a culture issue that's got to be solved in that department, and we can't continue to enable that kind of behavior.
Yeah, I'm curious about one aspect that you mentioned, Rodrigo, about having statistical redundancy. You know, I think it's a common fact that we have a shortage of biostatistics and bioinformatics people to begin with. So even getting the first round of analyses is challenging for many places. So the idea of getting a second or more independent analysis is going to be even more challenging. So I'm, while I like the sound of it, I'm curious if you think you can really implement that.
I admit that the resource issue I mentioned earlier will be very pervasive. I would just say that amongst statisticians that are interested in developing methodologies for complex data sets, this is a great opportunity. In other words, having the data sequestered somewhere and unavailable, as I alluded to earlier, stymies the methodologic development. Many of these individuals are actually looking for this data, scouring, you know, the internet as well as and public sites to find it, both not just to you know, to verify that the data is actually or the results are actually true, but also to use that for their own scholarly work. So I admit that there's a challenge there, but I also think the statistical community would actually view this as something that they would want to buy into.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think many faculty with graduate students are frustrated. They want to try out ideas or methodology, and they can't get access to the data, or the hurdles are so high they get discouraged and quit.
I hope that this gets into what do we hope for from this committee? We need more strong voices for more quantitative people, because despite the frustrations of grad students, there wouldn't be enough of them if all of this work was subjected to redundant statistical analysis. The workforce issues are profound. You know that better than I do.
We will get into these issues in greater depth also at the end of the day. I'd like to be able to...
Can I add, just briefly, to that point, again, from my perspective, you know, I can't really comment about how from an oversight perspective, you implement, you know, independent statistical review. But I would just say, as a statistician, I would certainly look for a partnership. And, you know, I think the way that I and many of the other faculty members in biostatistics work, particularly trying to focus on the open development and open source framework of things like the R bioconductor communities, and by developing the resources centrally at the university for data repositories, I think those can go along way towards being more efficient, because I agree, you know, the bandwidth issue is probably the most limiting effect of such a proposal.
Tom, can I ask a question? Some of the discussion has been about planning structures for accountability in the future, and I'm hoping either now or later we can talk some about the accountability system that was in place when all this stuff happened, because that's sort of the university which supervises the whole process. And the issue here is the lessons that you guys have learned from setting up a committee which ended up not getting the right answer and leading to further problems. Because if the university, I would expect that units and other smaller groups are not going to be able to do as good a job as the university. And for whatever structures get set up, are there lessons from what has gone on at the committee and with your insights we can explore to learn going forward how to really make the system work?
So we'd like to get to a series of questions that Dr. Gaylor has on the IRB, and I'd like to get to that within 5 minutes. So just a couple of very quick thoughts. Exactly as Dr. Ranzenhoff has said, one of the questions that we'd asked, and I think maybe the best way to address this is throughout the day, is what didn't work well? What are the aspects of the process that was in place didn't work well? Let's proceed with a lot of other related questions during the day. We can return to this at the end to have any summary comments that you have about that maybe didn't get adequately addressed. I wanted to pursue two other things very quickly. One is just to make sure I understood. When you talked about accountability plans, Rob, you mentioned there were two elements, and you started off with a system built on trust, and you talked about various aspects of that. Very quickly, what was the second element?
So the first was this culture of dissent and discussion.
Yes.
The second is the hardcore, what are your data systems like? What are your, what's your statistical support like? So that people explicitly report on that.
And so what we'd like to do during the day as well is get a sense of what didn't work well in those domains in the context of the past trials. There's one other question, and I'm going to try to make it shorter. You've already alluded to the fact that we mentioned the DCRU, and we had mentioned the DCRI and the CGSU. And many of us know well about the reputation and strong expertise in clinical trials, infrastructure, and design conduct analysis of trials that has been developed in the DCRI, which you mentioned is a multi-site structure, and the DCRU is more internal to Duke. It seemed as though the CGSU was now being developed that would be specific to the genomic studies unit, and part of what they needed to do was carry out clinical trials, design, conduct, and analysis when you had this great infrastructure in Duke, maybe for multi-site. Wasn't there a way, would there be a way to link it in rather than to start over? And wasn't that one of the difficulties is that the GCSU was coming on board without the rich, in-depth infrastructure that already existed on campus.
Let me make a, if you don't mind, let me make a quick point with regard to the thing you raised a minute ago about what didn't go well. You have a table that is in your publicly accessible information of 15 things that didn't go well. My point on this is, you know, we know a lot about medical errors now, and we talk about the Swiss cheese effect where all the holes have to line up. And it's my belief, at least having spent a lot of time on this the last 6 months, that these 15 things in general have worked well for the majority of things that we've done. I mean, our system has done well with high quality research that's been meaningful to the world. But these things, in this case, all lined up to produce the result that you saw. And we believe that with the adjustments going forward in all of these areas, that the odds of them all lining up again are quite small, not zero. And I don't think we can produce a zero error system. So with regard to the question about DCRI and DCRU, I'll ask Jeff to comment after I just introduce it by saying the fit, as you pointed out, is not perfect because the DCRI is set up to do multi-site research with all the issues that are involved there. There certainly are generalizable elements from that, but the real fundamental issue here, I think, is that Jeff's intent in the IGSP was to set up more of a consultative service that would help people understand the genomic components of clinical trials, which we could all benefit from, whether we're in the DCRI or somewhere else. But because our site-based research unit system was evolving, things got a bit jumbled up in terms of how it was being done. And I'll ask, so our solution going forward to this is that the GCSU is not conducting clinical trials. What it is now is a consultative service that regardless of where genomics are being done, it provides the insight and experience about how to prepare genomic materials, produce proper databases for genomic issues, and it's a site-based research unit's responsibility. If it's a site-based study, if it's a multi-site trial, it's a DCRI or the Cancer Institute or the Vaccine Institute's responsibility. Yeah.
Let me elaborate, and certainly I can add more detail as you would like. But in 2004, 2005, we set about to create a what I would call a core function within the IGSP that would cover the spectrum of studies and expertise that would be required for carrying out genomics research. So things that might seem somewhat mundane but fundamental, such as biospecimen procurement, quality, sample handling, and biobanking, access to a suite of genomic technologies as well as to the statistical components that would be required to measure or to make sense of the data that was coming out of them. And this concept evolved to serve a number of different groups within the research community. We started out actually working with cardiovascular investigators, and then began to think about what how this kind of platform, if you will, could actually serve as a clinical trial that was meant to have a genomic biomarker as an integral part of the study design. And this is where the notion of partnering with different units that would be actually responsible for carrying out the clinical trials component emerged. And we did have discussions with DCRI colleagues about not really of the type to actually carry out the clinical trials, but more they're just getting their expertise on what would be required. And eventually the partnership was appropriately with the medical oncology site-based research unit where oncology clinical trials were being carried out for a great long time. And as Rob indicated, you know, we at the outset tried to set up a structure where the genomics component, the CGSU, was performing its job, that is to assist with the biospecimen component, the assay component, and the analytical component. And then when a when the predictive models were information was emerged from those predictive models, that would be used for the clinical trials to select patients or to select therapies for the patients that were eligible. It became, as Rob used the term, jumbled. I would say it became the lines of between the CGSU and the clinical side became somewhat blurred, but mostly in one particular area, and that was in the area of data management. Initially, the oncology SBR team was responsible for all aspects of the clinical trial, including data management, but as time went on and the trials evolved and the amount of sheer workload of the trials increased, it was seen that data management just wasn't keeping up with the trials, and some of the genomics research coordinators began assisting in just data entry and data management. But that's really the only place, really, where there was, I would say, a significant blurring of the lines of responsibility. The IGSP was really responsible for the genomics expertise of the trial, and the PIs and the clinical oncology research unit, site-based research unit, was responsible for the clinical operations of the studies. Is that clear?
Yeah, I understood what you said, but what I'm struggling with is these trials that we were asked to consider appear to be have been being running outside the usual infrastructure that you had in place within the cancer center and or the CTSA. And what I'm struggling with is, and especially as things began to be a little more controversial or high profile, didn't anybody sort of recognize that things weren't going on as they normally would have been done? I mean, you say that things got murky, they got behind, but somewhere along the line, I'm struggling to know how did this go on without people saying, wait a minute, this isn't being done according to OIL.
I would say, I think what you're asking really is about the broader question of what was the oversight of this whole thing. So, and as in 2006 or so, and as the PIs were developing their trial designs, they were being, from the very beginning, these were reviewed by the CPC, the Cancer Protocol Review Committee, the IRB. Once the trials began, there was continuing oversight of the type that the IRB does, looking for adverse events and the like, as well as the institution of the DSMB Plus. And also, there was, at that time, some of the, and the SBR was also involved, but as Rob had indicated, that was an evolving structure. In the 2005-2006 timeframe, a lot of what the SBR was focused on was a lot of the fiduciary financial management of studies, and as time went on, the SBR grew to have expertise in many different aspects of running the clinical operations of the clinical trials. So I'll let maybe Sally or Rob comment on this, but I think it was just, as Rob said, sort of a timing event that things were happening as these trials were going on, as a number of systems were evolving, and certainly today it would be quite a different story.
Yeah, I'll just add one or two sentences to that, which is, you know, as they were alluding to, the system was nascent at that point, and things have changed very dramatically, I would say, in the last 2 years. And now, for instance, even within the Cancer Institute and the Cancer Protocol Review Committee, they've now instituted, rather than just sort of a, you know, group discussion on things, there's a statistical pre-review where if the statistician doesn't sign off, it doesn't even advance to the Cancer Protocol Review Committee stage. So I think, you know, the community is only as strong as they're empowered to be and as involved as the leadership is with the group. And as I said, now the SBR directors are essentially watching each other because they're meeting every week discussing all of their issues and problems and challenging each other if things don't seem to conform to the standards that we would want to have.
I know we're going to get into this in the next session probably, but one of the interesting things about the overall scenario as described is there were multiple people who looked at the overall design on the front end and who were monitoring. There also has been an internal audit and an FDA site visit, and the data that's in the case record forms does match the data that's in the patient's charts and all of that. What we're really talking about here is a part that I think the system often misses, which is the details of the operational management of the trial as it's ongoing. And it's very hard, as we'll get into, I think, for someone who's looking at a sheet of paper, just like it is to know that consent is being obtained appropriately when you're only looking at the consent form that comes into the IRB and not observing the consent. And so, you know, when you say according to Hoyle, Dave, I just in perspective want to make one comment. I mean, you well know that 80% of clinical trials are done by industry and managed by employees of a company or CRO hired by the industry. We hold ourselves to a higher standard in the not-for-profit academic world, we think, with regard to conflict, which we're going to get into. And this was an area where things got jumbled. And we think, in retrospect, should have been done differently. But I think part of the issue is it's falling in that area of operations, which is not what was the design of the protocol and not did the data match the case record forms.
So you've told us about a lot of features, a lot of components, the CGSU, the IGSP, the engagement of the site-based unit, the cancer center. There's still a sense, and we're going to pursue this throughout the day, of whether there was adequate clinical trials infrastructure in the design and throughout the quality of study conduct aspect of the studies. But we'll come back to that. We've got 15 minutes. Why don't we break now? Because we want to go into a series of questions that Gail is going to lead. And to stay on time, we need to start right at 10:15.